Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo Toronto Public Media and WBFO, this is What's Next, Producer's Picks. Highlights of conversations heard on previous episodes. On today's show.
And as the SPCA, you know, like I said, our mission is to keep pets with their people, but we really need key community partners who are already doing this work to get into the community, to gain the community's trust.
We welcome Kelly Wolf and Stephanie Pepper from the SPCA serving Erie County, as well as Rachel Terapaki from the Resource Council of Western New York. And we close with...
that we have. So we're looking at things from an asset-based,
okay,
you know, model and saying, these are the jewels. Like, the city's a jewel in itself. And I think people forget that we just simply need to polish the jewels so that they can shine.
We close with Dr. Karen Quandrans and Rhonda Bivens-Talley from Niagara University. I'm Michael Loss. First, we revisit Thomas O'Neill White's conversation with Kelly Wolf and Stephanie Pepper from the SPCA serving Erie County, joined by Rachel Terapaki from the Resource Council of Western New York. The four discuss an incubator grant awarded to the SPCA that aims to create better access to veterinary resources on the east side of Buffalo.
Kelly and Stephanie, tell us a little bit about the SPCA serving Erie County.
So the SPCA serving Erie County has been in our community for over 150 years. And one of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand about the SPCA is we are truly committed to research-based programs that create long-lasting change and equity in our community. We want to be responsive to the community, and we've been evolving for 150 years to be responsive to the community. We're so much more than adoptions and where you go to get your new cat.
So in this evolution, you know, recognizing barriers faced by underserved communities, obviously it's nothing new, but it's been especially highlighted in this area after the Tops tragedy of May 14th. But let's talk about this topic, addressing veterinary care access on Buffalo's east side, specifically the 14208 area, which is the Kingsley Maston area. So why does this need exist, and how was it initially identified by the SPCA?
So a really brief shift in the SPCA over the last few years is, before, we used to just take in every animal that would come to us, and we shifted to a community model. So we want to look at why animals are coming to us in the first place, and mm-hmm. how can we keep pets with their people? And that's the core of our mission now. So as we looked at this, we saw that people couldn't afford vet care, and so they were bringing their dogs and cats to us because they had no other option, or they were evicted and they didn't have housing that they could find that would allow their animal to come to them. So we really started looking at the parts of Buffalo where the most people were coming to us and where they had the least amount of resources. And so that's what led us to applying for this grant for the PetSmart charities. And Steph, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about, because you were there when we responded to the Tops tragedy and how we ended up in this neighborhood.
So after the Tops tragedy, our CEO, Kate Daly, said, you know, we need to be a part, we need to help the community, we need to support the community, mm-hmm. more in fact, support. So we had food and pet supplies, and we helped provide that for the community. And the one thing she had stated was, if you are going, you are not leaving. You need to be a part of this community. And when the incubator grant came, you know, was possible, this is where we truly wanted to focus our time and support with that community.
Mm. I was going to say
real quick, what was the feedback from the community on that day that you initially showed up?
You know, I think obviously they were thankful. Pets are such an important part of
right.
people's lives. They provide, you know, loving, and they're, oh my gosh, here I am.
I mean, we're all, I think anyone you run into is probably a SPCA family, mine included.
Right. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, pets, again, are such an important part. And, you know, people have to make choices. Are they, when they are faced with barriers and financial barriers, are they able to feed themselves or their pets? And that's just not a choice we want people to have to make. So if we can help support them and provide food and supplies for their animals, then they can focus their time on themselves. So if we can just ease that piece.
And in addition, so we were already in this community, and when the PetSmart Charities grant, the incubator grant came up, we really did a lot of research about what is the access in the community? Mm-hmm. What do people need? And I was shocked to find, because I'm not from Buffalo, that Buffalo is the third poorest city in the nation.
Unfortunately.
And I was also, in doing research to write this grant, startled to find that it's the east side is, or I guess the city as a whole, is the 12th most segregated city in the country. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know that, not being from here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really started looking at the systemic reasons that mm-hmm. that was, that the policies that were being put in place. And as the SPCA, you know, like I said, our mission is to keep pets with their people, but we really need key community partners who are already doing this work to get into the community, to gain the community's trust. And if I'm being frank, we were going in as law enforcement. We have a humane law enforcement officer team, and they were going in and they were taking animals. And when we were looking at, you know, who we want to be as an organization, we don't want to be a punitive organization. We don't want to punish people for poverty. That is not our mission. So we really had to look at, how are we supporting these communities? How can we go in and provide meaningful services? And when our law enforcement goes out, you know, sometimes it was the dogs were bald because they went to the house because there's a flea infestation. That's not someone who doesn't love their animals. That's someone who can't afford astronomically priced flea treatment.
Right.
Or medical care. So as an organization, our board, our senior leadership started looking at, how are we going to shift so that we truly can serve our community in a meaningful way?
So we rebranded our outreach team to Animal and Community Centered Engagement Support Services. We are proactive instead of reactive, proactive instead of punitive. We have our law enforcement team. They work directly with our outreach team. They're out there. They are, again, as Kelly said, they're being proactive instead of punitive. We are taking situations where individuals have a severely matted dog, and in the past, that would be something we would charge them for animal cruelty. Now we're taking a look at it and saying, you know what, they just can't afford or don't have access to a groomer, and what can we do? Let's help them. So we have taken in dogs, we have groomed them, and then given them back to their owners. That is what we are doing now, and that is truly what is needed by the community. There are times, yes, when we need to be law enforcement, but the majority of the time, we're there just to assist. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just, we've found, is a better way, and that is the way the animal welfare community in general is shifting.
Mm-hmm. And in order to do this, you know, that leaves room in the shelter for the animals that truly need us.
Mm-hmm.
But again, going into a community that is not trusting of outsiders, they're not trusting of, because there have been so many fly-by-night people coming in with a help. We had to go to some amazing partners, and we were really lucky to have partners like Rachel and her organization open up their doors and say, let me help you. I know this community. And we have a lot of barriers to overcome still on our own, because we were law enforcement going into that community for a long time.
We and are so not Rachel welcome is our, at some point.
Yeah, let's bring Rachel in. Tell us about the work that you're doing and this kind of partnership with SPCA.
Sure. Resource Council's been around. I've been there a little bit over 3 years. They opened their doors in June of 2021, which is right off the back of COVID. And we like to serve whole families, and that includes pets. So we have programming, free programming, from after school to food markets to food pantries to after school summer camps. We do senior programming. We have yoga. We have basketball programs to keep kids off the streets. So the East Side, again, is not a very trusting community with good reasons. So once we showed, hey, we're here, we're staying, our doors are open, the pool's open, the gym's open, you know, come on in and all the services are free. We just want everybody safe, healthy, and happy. I think that, again, serving a whole family counts with animals. It counts with kids. I've been in education for 23 years, so I see that a kid flourishes when their family is intact and has all the services and access to things that they need. So for us, it's just serving the whole family and community, because after TOPS happened, we were there day one. So we got to see, you know, how much people needed and how much they did need their animals. I mean, that is a support system. That's loyalty. That's love. People were hurting. We were all hurting. And then to, on top of it, say, I'm sorry you went through this. You now don't have access to food. Now your animals are going to suffer too. It's just, it's not fair. So when Tyler is part of the outreach, he came to me and he was like, hey, I saw what you guys do. You know, can we come in? And I was like, sure. And then he said, we're going to ask people what they need. And I was like, absolutely. Because so many people in high poverty neighborhoods are told what they need. And that's not okay. I don't agree with that. I never have. Even for our kids. Like, what do you need? What do you want? What do you need from us? And how can we help you? So this was just a no-brainer.
And so this $100,000 grant from PetSmart Charities, it's an incubator program. But right now you are in phase one. Talk a little bit about phase one and then on to phase two.
So phase one is going into the community, and the focus of this part of phase one and this cohort is urban communities of color. And we are looking at building relationships with the actual community. And obviously there is a trust barrier, and it's something we are really trying to, you know, gain the trust of the community. And by doing that, we are offering food, supplies, just being there. It doesn't even have to be, you know, we're here to provide vet care, and that's not something we have done as of yet. But we want to, we held focus groups. It's one of the first things that we did, just to find out what is their concern? What is their concern with safety in their community? What is it, the most important thing for them and their pet? How are pets important to them? Just finding that information. And then we took the focus group information and we had a survey built for us through the University of Denver IHAC program. And we are now in the process of surveying the community. What is it that they need? And that's the key to this point, is finding out what they need. And then phase two will be implementing the things that they needed. So it could be, actually, I don't even know. It could be they're interested in grooming, or maybe it's vaccinations are something that's super important to them. So we can hold vaccination clinics, or is it a mobile, you know, clinic for them? We have no idea. But once we do know, then we can go and work on providing that with the second phase.
And that's that was all that information would is gained from those focus groups.
Yes, focus groups, surveys.
And when I read the surveys at first, you know, we've been working in this community for a long time. So we have an assumption, right? We assume people need free vet care. What we have been finding is that people are not asking for free vet care. So in the East Side as a whole, outside of this zip code specifically, we have been doing vaccine clinics. And what people have identified is they just want affordable access. They just want access. So, you know, in looking at what our next steps are going to be, you know, the focus group also identified, I think a lot of times people will come in with this answer of, we should have a dog park. People love dogs. We should have a dog park. Well, one of the huge concerns of the people on the East Side is that so many animals aren't vaccinated. They don't want their dogs in a dog park with unvaccinated animals that are going to make them sick. You know,
behavior
was a huge concern. How do we train our animals? We don't have access to trainers. We don't have access to groomers.
And then what do we do to break down those barriers to make sure that the individuals, the community members, are able to access things that we could just go out and get easily ourselves?
And we have to look at income. We have to be realistic.
Absolutely.
We can't go in and say, we're going to spay and neuter everything on this block. Because there are people who make money off their animals. There are people who sell puppies, and that's how they make money. So we have to go in and overcome the misperceptions. We have to do a lot of education. And that's why we're doing the surveys and meeting with the community, because we could meet with 15 people. They could say, I need vet care, and we can put a bus together and we could be there in 3 weeks. You know what I mean? Assuming our donors would support it. But we really want to look at every aspect of why people are making the decisions that they're making and understand them.
Exactly. And meet them where they are. And we're not there to judge or anything along those lines. If that's what they need, then that's fine. But how can we support you? Is there something we can do? And we know we can't do this alone. And it's so, we are so grateful to Rachel and the Resource Council, because honestly, we could not do what we're doing without them.
And so phase two would just be implementation of everything you got during the focus groups and everything else. And this is a, this is 3 years or 4 years?
Depending on our results, as long as we don't screw this up, they will fund us for 2 to 3 more years, depending on what we find. And that's the beautiful thing about working with PetSmart, is they really, really want to know what we need. And they're being responsive in the moment with the funding. So we actually have gone in and we've hired people from this community. So we have our two leads from the SPCA who are going into the community, Tyler and Amy, who are working with Rachel. But we also are trying to hire people part-time from within the community to do some of this work.
Yeah, Rachel, can you talk a little bit about going into the community with two SPCA employees and the work you're going to be doing there?
Sure. Honestly, a lot of people come to us. So twice a month, we have something called Resource Connection Day. So there's between 15 and 30 organizations that come in like a one-stop shop. So we have anything from National Fuel to HEAP to healthcare, legal services, things that people need but don't have transportation to get there. So you're not taking a bus to 15 different organizations that are placed all over the city of Buffalo. Sure, in a car, it's a 12-minute ride. On a bus, it could be 3 to 5 hours of your day if you have kids, if there's things you need to get home to. So just knowing that, and I told Tyler, I said, let me help you. Again, people come to us. They understand that the Resource Council is there to help in all aspects. Again, whole family needs. Let me be the face at first and bring you in. So when we did the focus group, it was like 2 hours of just asking questions of what do you need? There's surveys and questions that make sense. So just having the community understand that we are here, we are helping, and seeing all these new faces aren't scary, and knowing that they really are here to stay and listen, right? So people don't like being told what they need. They like to tell you what they need, right? Because they know what they need. So being in the community, just seeing our kids and our people, and again, it's 4 hours twice a month. People are in there, 100 to 300 people, farmers markets, the food pantry. It's just seeing the same people and seeing everybody else like, oh, I went here for this. Where'd you get that from? Or how do you do this? Or how do you get this? It's one area that is fully accessible to the east side by walking. If there's an issue, like they said, they can bring it to their, you know, Ruby, she just got a second dog. It's a pom, she's very cute. But she doesn't have the access to take a 30-pound bag of dog food back to her house. So the SPCA will come and deliver it. So then the neighbors see like, oh, what do you got there? How did you get this? How do I get that? And then it just becomes word of mouth. And then it becomes, oh, I can just walk down the street and get everything I need, from pet care to legal aid to my National Fuel bill, help with, you know, rental services. It's just a one-stop shop for an entire family and anything that you could possibly need.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate here for just a minute. Some people might say, you know, wouldn't it be easier to provide vet access in underserved communities by putting, say, a PetSmart in these communities? Smack dab, maybe on Jefferson, maybe on Bailey, something like that. Because to my knowledge, there are no PetSmarts on Buffalo's east side.
No, and that's one of the things, to Stephanie's point, when people were talking to us, they said, we don't need access to food. We need access to healthy food for our pets. We need access to quality food. Would a, you know, a PetSmart in the neighborhood be great? Possibly. But PetSmart itself recognizes, and that's why they do this grant, that it may not be the answer. People may not be able to afford what's in that store. They may not be able to afford the veterinary care. The SPCA operates a low-cost veterinary clinic currently at our shelter called the Lipsy Veterinary Clinic. And we have a program called Oasis, where it's sliding scale. If you come in for, you know, you have a catastrophic emergency with your animal, when you take it to emergency vet, the only option is pay or euthanize, which sometimes a shelter gets a rep for that, but they don't realize that we are going to work to save these animals. And so we want that access to be available in all the communities. And we really do need to ask the community, what is helpful to you? What is helpful? Because we could show up with a vet clinic.
Right.
Will people trust us enough to use it? I don't know. And we have to figure out, what can people afford? That's the other part of this. Mm-hmm. What can people afford? We can make assumptions. We can work on sliding scale, but we have to look at, how are we going to fund this? And what can people afford? The other piece that we have to work with, you know, so we're working with the Resource Council. We're working with probably 30 different organizations throughout the city at this point. And we also have to work with our legislators. We also have to work with the people who are making these laws. So this is a broader issue, and the SPCA is doing what it can. But we also recognize mission creep. We also have donors that we answer to who really want to understand what we're doing, and we treat our donors as partners. But we need to say, what services are there in the community? What can we use and what can we expand on that's already happening? How can, you know, we've met with some legislators recently that say, okay, let's work together on this. Let's come together and say, how are we going to overcome the fact that there is not affordable housing that allows pets? There's not even unaffordable housing that allows pets, honestly.
Right.
Right.
You know, you can pay $2,500 a month. They still don't want your dog. Exactly.
I just want to circle back to just the issue of trust when going into a new community and you know, making sure that that community realizes that, you know, you're here for the long haul. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I think that's such a important part of what you guys do, and you know, other people that have come on this show before, just being breaking down that trust and building it up.
I think so. One of the things, I was a social worker for many years before going into animal welfare, and I worked, you know, door to door in communities, and I didn't look like a lot of the communities that I worked in. And we're taking the lessons learned going into different communities, but it took us a while for people to realize who we were as law enforcement and as the people who took their animals. It's going to take a while to change that.
Yes.
And we understand that. And that's why we know we're here for the long haul. Having people vouch for us in the community and just doing the good work that shows that we're showing up. Showing up at someone's door with a bag of food and seeing that those animals need additional help and not sending a law enforcement agent out is going to go a long way.
What can we do to support you?
Do?
And even just being there, it doesn't even, you know, we had a microchip clinic. There was hot dogs, food, just being at different community events, tabling, you know, those are things that I think are truly important. Just
the visibility.
Them seeing our face. You know, we had a microchip clinic at the Resource Council, you know, a few weeks ago. And then I showed up at True Bethel Baptist Church for a vaccine clinic. And a woman walked up and said, I remember you. Yes, you do. So it's just making sure that we are visible, providing support, and not making assumptions, and just truly listening to the community members and asking, what do you need? And I think that truly will be
we're
the
starting to
force.
See it. So we were having a vaccine clinic. We have a vet tech that goes on the road with this outreach team. So she's phenomenal and is one of the most supportive people. She could talk to anybody. So a woman came over from across the street and just said, what are you guys doing? No, she didn't bring an animal with her. We're clearly doing a vaccine clinic. So we start talking about what we're doing, the services that we could provide. And Sarah, who's our vet tech, went over to her and said, you know, this is who we are. This is what we're doing. We're here to support the community. And the woman still was very hesitant. And so Sarah was able to give her a collar and a harness for her dog because she didn't have it. And the woman was scared to bring us her dog because it had lost a bunch of fur. It had, we believe at that time, flea dermatitis. And she was terrified that if she brought this dog over to this vaccine clinic, we would say, you're not taking care of your dog.
Yeah, we're going to take your dog. Yeah.
We're going to take your dog. So Sarah was able in that moment to gain some trust. We were able to get the dog over to the vaccine clinic. She was able to get some vaccines. She was able to get some pet food. And our veterinarian saw the dog and was able to say, this is what's going on and this is how we can help you. We pass out flea treatment. We actually have another case, and it wasn't an outreach case. It was a law enforcement case where we got called out to a house where we were called by an emergency vet clinic because a cat was brought to the vet clinic that had died. And it had died because of flea anemia. It was so infested with fleas. And we were able to go out, meet with the family, see what's going on. They had 9 other cats in the house. And don't quote me on the 9. But there were quite a few cats in the house. Now that I say
more
that.
More than 2. Yes.
But we were able to go out, pick up all those animals, bring them back to our shelter, start treating them for the flea anemia. They needed fluids. They needed intense medical care. In the meantime, we were working with one of our community partners who provides flea extermination. We don't want it to stop right there. So we mm-hmm. have a community partner, Mosquito Hunters, that's lovely. And we called the owners and we said, here's what we're dealing with. They said, we're going to go in and treat this house for free. So the SPCA held on to the cats. We treated the animals. There were a few kittens that they didn't want returned to the house, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to rehome those kittens. And then the cats that they had, we made sure that they were completely up to date on everything. We've treated the house now. And they can go back. And the humans were suffering, too. I mean, if your cats are that infested with fleas, so are you.
Mm-hmm.
We're able to send them home with additional flea treatment. And our law enforcement officers can go out and check on them and make sure everyone's still doing okay. And that's an example of the shift that we've had in law enforcement. Because before, we would have taken those 9 cats, years before, and charged those people.
It's changing the narrative.
It's changing
the narrative. That's exactly it.
And within that, I mean, you say law enforcement, but does that name need a rebrand as well? Because, you know, mm-hmm. when we think law enforcement,
right.
you know, we think in the negative.
So yes and no. We do have people who commit crimes against animals and need to be punished.
Yes.
So that's why we have rebranded and sort of split our law enforcement almost in half. Mm-hmm. So we have the access team, and then we have our humane law enforcement, and they are police officers. They are, you know, going out and enforcing animal cruelty laws.
Mm-hmm.
When they go out to a house and it is a true situation where the people just do not have what they need to take care of their animals, they are not punishing them. We are going through access. We're getting them into our clinic, and we're getting these animals helped. But if we go out and this person just beat their dog or stabbed their dog,
right.
that's
we are pressing charges.
That's right. different.
Because those people do need to be held accountable. So it's finding that balance, and we're still trying mm-hmm. to find that balance.
Now, do the officers, you know, if they come into a home, they assess the situation, is that also like a red light, green light, yellow light mm-hmm. thing?
Absolutely. And the first thing they're going to do is provide support. Mm-hmm. If there is a way to keep an animal in their home and look at the need of the family and the animals, that's the first thing that they're going to do. They're going to work with the individuals. We know that animals are better off in their homes. But if it is a blatant cruelty situation, mm-hmm. then that's when they're going to charge and go further with
the
that.
The other side of this is that shelters are in crisis right now. Shelters across the country are in crisis. We are inundated with animals because people are in crisis. And when people cannot afford to take care of themselves, they cannot afford to take care of their animals. We have seen across the country a drop in adoptions.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this with, you know, the triaging is not just how can we help, but also do we have space to help? So for us, when we have a full adoption floor and we're running all these promotions to try to find wonderful homes for these animals, it just makes sense. It makes business sense to keep pets in homes that they already know and love. You know, it's helping the community, but it's also helping the shelter because we desperately need people to come in and show up and adopt our animals.
That was Kelly Wolf and Stephanie Pepper from the SPCA serving Erie County, alongside Rachel Terapaki from the Resource Council of Western New York. We close out today's show with Jay Moran sitting down with Dr. Karen Quandrance, the Associate Vice President of Niagara University, and Rhonda Bivens-Talley, the Executive Director of the Levesque Institute. The three discussed the work of the Levesque Institute, which is Niagara University's Center for Civic Engagement and Community Impact.
I want to before we get into the work of the Levesque Institute, I am thrilled that we have two Niagara Falls people with Niagara Falls in their blood. You guys both grew up in Niagara Falls, went to school in Niagara Falls. Let's just a general conversation. And I know the Levesque Institute is about looking forward and trying to find and make a difference in the community. But what about Niagara Falls? What What should we understand about the current state of Niagara Falls right now?
Well, I think like many other cities, Niagara Falls had some issues. And so it might not look like how we remember it. You know, we had the Winter Garden, and we had Lackey Plaza, we had the downtown mall, things like that. And, you know, we're hoping that through collective impact, we could see some of those things again. Our neighborhoods, like other neighborhoods, have some challenges. We have old housing stock, we have needs for housing improvement, and there's a lot of people working on that right now.
Right.
All right.
So we're hopeful.
Right. The other thing is we've had a number of people leave the city, right? So that's another thing, too. So you look at economic development, we don't have as many people investing in our communities either. So we're looking at ways to, like she said, revitalize the city, but also look at some of the issues and needs that we can address with the resources that we have.
And it's interesting, talking about, you know, our little pre-interview conversation here. Rhonda, you may have mentioned it 10 times. Opportunities. You see it as opportunities. And again, you know, people have left Niagara Falls, just like in Buffalo. We see it in Buffalo. Some neighborhoods have turned around in the last decade and have become thriving, almost difficult places to move into after being poverty stricken and really the source of crumble to a certain extent. But so what about the opportunities that you see in Niagara Falls?
Well, there are many. So we're looking at, Karen spoke to what Niagara used to be. We're looking at what we're looking to have it become, right? That place, we have 8 million people, 9 million people visit every year. We want people to have reasons to come, but also stay. Mm. But more importantly, thinking about our residents. Mm-hmm. Thinking about our residents, not just tourism, but really looking at what are we offering our residents and what's needed in our community for our residents, right? Making sure we have resources and services and places to go, entertainment. Right. So we're looking at those places. So making sure that, you know, while we want Niagara to be a destination, we also want to make it a great place to live and have safe neighborhoods for people that are in the residence, you know, so they can enjoy entertainment year round and also have great jobs, good paying jobs. Right. Access to education, equal opportunities for education and training programs and things of that nature. And we do that by working with our community partners, which we'll talk more about. So, you know, like she said, we had great experiences growing up in the city of Niagara Falls, and we love our city, right? And we want to be able to show that love and how much we love our city by working with other people to be able to, you know, revitalize our neighborhood. So we're looking at, not just looking at, oh, we're doing all these things in the city, but really looking at being strategic and looking at neighborhoods. Like, how do we develop neighborhoods one at a time, you know, block by block to make these changes?
And this didn't happen overnight. You know, so it's going to take a little bit of undoing, but I think what I keep telling people is the time is right now. I've never seen the city, the county, the state. As I mentioned, the president of Niagara University, Father Marr, he is 100% committed to our city of Niagara Falls and us really using the resources at Niagara University to do what we can through research, through impact to assist in that. But we've got so many community-based organizations all working towards the same goal. We've got, like I said, the support from the mayor on down, the city council, really to turn this around. And I don't think I've seen a time with more funding, more enthusiasm, and more expertise coming to this area to work on this revitalization. So it's exciting. I'm excited right now.
Yeah, no doubt. That was what I was going to mention when, again, in the pre-interview conversation, that is what emits from the two of you, excitement about what's ahead here for Niagara Falls through the Levesque Institute. So let's get into that. I'm also interested in, and I think this is worth discussing, how you've gone about, you know, kind of accumulating your narrative to a certain extent. You know, I mean, there's lots of facts, there's census, there's things along those lines, but you've also done a certain amount of outreach as well to try to really gauge what's happening in Niagara Falls.
Yeah, so we get generous funding through the Oshai Foundation, and we really want to know what our residents want, what our block clubs want, what the community needs are. So through that, we started with an intensive literature review of best practices for community and university collaboration not coming in and telling, but collaboration. And so that led to us doing focus groups. We at the Niagara Falls Housing Authority, at the Senior Center, at Heart, Love, and Soul, one of our great community-based partners. And it was all ages and great participation. And we really listened to what they're looking for. Housing was an area of need. Workforce development, an area of need. And computer skills, credit scores, things like that. So that was our charge to get going. Levesque Institute has four pillars, but through my role, I'm able to do all the overspill, but really looking at that community engagement and what are your top areas and what resources can we bring to that?
Right. And it's important that we're not just talking about these issues, but we're putting action to them. Right. So I think that's the other piece when we talk about what's happening in communities. So many communities, that's often what happens. People say, oh, yeah, we talked about it.
Right.
You know, there was a study that was done, you know, and but we're saying, nope. Let me show you what we're doing. We're actually listening to what you're saying. And this is what we're doing based on that. So when we've had these community conversations, we've had these surveys. Right. And we've taken information and suggestions from community members. And then as a result, implemented different programs and services or found different partners so that they could be able to offer different services and resources to address some of the concerns of our people in the community.
What might be some of the examples of that? And it's interesting that, like you said, that is such a big, I guess, critique of efforts to try to improve things. There's a lot of conversation, but not always a lot of action.
No. And like Karen will talk more about like the housing study that came out of that, but some of the other issues.
Talk about
the speakers. Yep, the speakers. So having other people that have been successful in trying to do the work that we've done, having those people come and speak to the residents, right. Say, these are the things that we did, this is how we do it. And having them even come in and look around our city and say, you know, well, what do you think? You know, and look at the assets that we have. So we're looking at things from an asset-based,
okay. You
know, model and saying, these are the jewels. Like the city's a jewel in itself. And I think people forget that we just simply need to polish the jewels so that they can shine. So we're making sure that some of those things that we've done, maybe it may be offering a small business, like we did a multicultural business lab with M&T Bank. So we partnered with them to offer first the networking event so that people know about the resources.
Right.
If you're trying to start a small business, where do you go to do that, right? If you need a business plan, where do you go for that? Who offers that? What do you do if you're trying to get your MWBE certification, or some minority and women's business enterprise, you know, certificates and things like that and contracts? Where do you go to do those things? So we held a networking event on the campus in December, and we had a great turnout. We had 60 people come out to learn, and it wasn't just about having the conversation. We had people in the rooms, right? So those community-based organizations and city resources, so that people knew, but these are the people you talk to. So we didn't just talk about where to go and what you can do. As a social worker by trade, one of my pet peeves has always been that you tell people where to go, you hand them a card, right? So then you don't follow up. So my thing is, nope, let's do this right here and now and give people more bang for the buck. You show up, I'll give you what you need.
Yeah, so it was really nice. Because, like Rhonda said, there are people there in all stages of their business, you know, idea to where do I go next? We had panelists, most of which were Niagara University graduates, small businesses. But when someone in the audience was asking them a question, they go, you go right there, because we had the Small Business Development Center there. We had the city there. We had M&T Bank there. I mean, it wasn't like, where do I go next? It was, that's exactly who I talked to. And the business owners themselves would say, come talk to me after this and I'll tell you what I did. So based on the success of that event in December, M&T Bank paired with Niagara University and we did a small multicultural business lab.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was 5 weeks of training, getting people from idea to really having a solid business plan with a pitch contest at the end.
Oh.
Yeah. So that was really, really nice. We were there and helped with the five people who were selected. And there was prizes for 1, 2, and 3. So we hope to do that again. And these multicultural business labs, M&T has one held one in Camden, New Jersey, and in Harlem and in Buffalo in the past. So we're really happy based on the number of people who participate in the networking event that they felt it was valuable to have one in the city of Niagara Falls as well. So just another opportunity.
Right.
And what was interesting about that is the majority of businesses, all of the businesses that completed the program and who were in the pitch contest, they were women-owned businesses. So that was very unique, right? So they're minority women-owned businesses. And to know that they now, with the pitch contest, there was $10,000 in prize money that M&T sponsored. So it was great that they were able to see their businesses flourish, and you know, and we could also help them advertise their businesses.
Right.
So they got good, you know, good spotlight on their businesses as well. But be able to go out to the community and also say, oh, you know, we participated in this program, and now they get to, you know, we get that, I guess, community credit now, right, for doing something that we said we would do, partnering with our other partners, business partners and everything else, right? And utilizing resources so that people know this wasn't something that just we are doing at Niagara University this one time, but to understand that there are so many people working with us to be able to offer these resources and services, and that we're not just talking about them. We're actually making sure we're connecting people to those resources.
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Besides, you know, at Niagara University hosting and Rhonda being on the committee to get, make sure they could get, we had a faculty member who spent every week there, and you know, he's committed. Like, so some of these women who still had questions, of course he's still going to work with them. So I can't thank him enough.
Right. And you mentioned multicultural, right?
Oh yeah.
So when I expand on what that means.
Well, you needed to be a minority candidate to participate in this. So very intentional on who we were looking to give resources to. And we're hoping, you know, that people see that there's supports out there for them. And that if they have even the slightest idea of entrepreneurship, you know, small businesses make up the majority of businesses in the United States, that there is support for them in Niagara County and in City of Niagara Falls for their businesses. And, you know, my hope is, you know, we revitalize the Main Street area of the City of Niagara Falls, and we have plenty of small businesses who are ready to go to move in.
Right. Right, 'cause that's a backbone of usually with cities, right? Mm-hmm. Those small businesses.
Sure.
Absolutely.
And being able to support them and making sure that they're thriving.
It's interesting also how you talk about best practices. It's interesting, these speakers that you've been able to bring in. Let's talk a little bit about what you're hearing coming from those ideas about best practices. Because like you said, this is, you know, a university has a great freedom to do certain things that a lot of other institutions don't. At the same time, there are not necessarily limitations, but the mission of a university, they can vary depending on the way the wind blows, for that matter. But now you're learning about the best ways to go about doing this. What are you hearing?
Well, the most important thing is to not come into a community and say what the best practice is according to you. It's making sure that you're coming and working with a community and listening to those voices and collectively working with them to say, okay, are these the things you're looking for? What I'm hearing you say is you want and you need these things. And then looking back at our resources and being able to say, well, what can we offer along these lines? So it's important to know how you approach a community. Right. You just don't go in and say, I have the best practice. I know what you need.
Right.
We have to make sure that we first are listening, because at the end of the day, yes, there are needs. Right. There are all sorts of needs. But depending on how the community views things, because they're looking and say, no, we have that. And we're coming in. If you're looking at things from an asset based eye, you're looking at what already exists, what's already working, and how can we support what's working, you know, and be realistic and prioritize the things that are needed. Right. So we're not just coming in and saying, well, we're going to do this. Right. You just don't come into a community that way. You make sure you're listening to the voice of the people, because they're the experts about what is needed in the communities, because they're in the community every day. Right. And a number of people have already been doing some of that work. There's that grassroots work that's been going on that's never stopped.
Right.
Right. So really, how are we tapping into what's already out there, already happening, and how do we add to that? So how do we support and supplement some of those things utilizing the resources that we have?
Yeah, sometimes we want people at the table, you know, rightly so. Like, you know, you need to be at the table. You need to be telling us about your community and what your needs are and how we could assist with what you already have doing. Sometimes we're invited to the table, so that's nice as well. You know, we have this initiative going on. It'd be really nice if Niagara University could assist us with this or support us with this. And so that's just as nice to be invited to the table as it is to know that we need people at the table to make you know, informed decisions and to make the changes that everybody's looking for.
And that's the goal, too, to be invited, because in that way, you know, you're doing what's needed and what's right. So it's a matter of being invited into a space as well. So because then there's that trust, right? Mm-hmm. You know, you've earned that trust, and that takes time. Right. What's good for us is that we've been doing this kind of work a long time and we're residents of the city. So we have those relationships that we came to Niagara with, and we're just expanding on those relationships by some of the utilizing resources and partners that already were at the university. But really being able to say, what are we all bringing to the table? Right. One of the things that Karen often says, which I'm going to steal it right now.
Okay.
there's this really big pie. There's this really big pie, and we all can have a slice of the pie. Right. And really be at and have a feast in the end. Right. So it's not really about you having more than I have and putting more on a plate and someone else doesn't have anything on the plate. But really, how do we all, you know, how do we feast together? Right. And how do we create a better meal than we would have individually?
And also, I always say it's a big pie. We don't all have to take the same piece.
Right.
So there are people who do things better than Niagara University. There's people who need Niagara University.
Right.
So we'll just take a different piece, but we all have the collective pie, right?
Right.
It's interesting also to hear talk about working with grassroots organizations already doing the work and trying to gauge where they're at, you know, how effective they are. But maybe it's always interesting, I think, to hear about some of those particular efforts, you know, and again, Niagara Falls, we've talked a lot of organizations here in Buffalo that are trying to do a lot of that work. But let's maybe just to kind of touch upon what's going on in Niagara Falls, what you're seeing and some of the successes that you're seeing and some of the, you know, maybe issues that, well, obviously we'll get into a little bit more that need to be addressed as we move forward.
Well, one of the things also for really is a big issue, and that's everywhere, I think, across the United States and other places, is food insecurity. That's one of the issues. Housing, some of those things that are happening. So it's we've had success with community gardens. So this was something before we came to Niagara. The Levesque Institute had a grant where they went into the community and they were doing things with community gardens, right? So we're looking at the idea of food sustainability by helping people learn to start their own gardens, right? Okay. As we put them in different pockets of the community, at community-based organizations, some schools, even at maybe some of the residential spaces like the assisted living, Niagara Arts and Community Center, they have a community garden and they use their produce to actually run their restaurant, right? So looking at how do we create more sustainability by partnering with the residents and other community-based organizations to find these spaces where we can input these community gardens so that we have an abundance of produce in the area. So, you know, when you look at the distance and, you know, for when there are grocery stores, we tend to have more convenience stores in some neighborhoods more so than others. So looking at even, you know, one of the efforts from Field and Fork, one of the partners, is looking at those convenience stores. What are they offering, right? How do we change what's being offered in a community, a convenience store, so that there are healthier options for people? So those are some of the things we're talking about, looking at addressing certain issues. So whether it's putting in a community garden, whether it's looking at, you know, what's available in a community in a convenience store so that's healthy for people to go to. Those are the types of grassroots things that we're doing. Looking at making sure that people have access to healthcare, right? So partnering with the community health clinic, and we do the health fairs and being a part of what's already happened in the community, but adding to that, right? So bringing resources, whether it's students or whether we're looking at grants to be able to maybe offer things where we're educating some of the health professionals, looking at literacy issues and working with our families to make sure that they have access to healthcare, right? Things like that. So when we're talking about these grassroots things, we're looking at you know, mental health. One of our partners just down the road is the Community Health Clinic of Niagara, which you have it here in Buffalo and it's in
right.
You know, Lockport and all the other places. Well, that's one of our partners. So we work with them and we look at even behavioral health, right? Bell Self has worked with us to offer mental health first aid training for our students as well as faculty and staff. I went through the training myself so that we can actually be first responders when we're helping people to identify and help them get help for any type of mental health challenges they may have. We've partnered with one of your guests that you've had, a former guest, BFNC. You know, we did a community health, mental health awareness weekend. I co-chaired one of the events that they had a couple of years ago, and they continue to offer these services, right? But making sure that we have more people getting the word out about these resources and where they are and how to access them. So working with all of our partners, there are all of these different grassroots efforts that are going on, block clubs, right? Mm-hmm. Supporting our block clubs and finding grant funds for them so that they can help make our neighborhood safer. Working with the city to be able to, you know, offer supports to our block clubs and things of that nature. You know, we have community missions that's doing a lot of things. So we are continuing this work. And like I said, there are those grassroots efforts, but really being able to tap into them and be able to really just better support what's already out there and happening.
I don't think there isn't a community-based organization that we don't work with or we don't have student workers at. We had, again, through the OSHI, the opportunity to fund paid internships. And I wrote that very specifically for community-based organizations in the city of Niagara Falls. So like many businesses who are finding it difficult to hire, you know, staff, our community-based organizations are dealing with the same issues. We have, don't have the number in front of me, but it has to be over 40 students now who have had paid internships mm-hmm. in our community-based organizations. And due to that, four have been offered jobs there. Mm-hmm. So that's what we were hoping, that students had a really good experience and that it worked out really well for our community-based organizations and that there was this awareness of a need. And that in the end, they'd be offered jobs. I had one community-based organization, which I won't mention, who said, how do we keep our student? How do we keep our student? I go, well, you hire them. That's how you keep your student. You hire them. So it wasn't just following someone around or doing filing. You know, they took over positions that they're either someone retired or they were unfilled or, you know, something they've already always wanted, but, you know, didn't have the funds to have. So it was a great learning experience for our students. And not one community-based organization said this didn't work out. Right. I mean, it just beautiful. Just
and
beautiful.
That element of the Levesque Institute is not a small element. The student involvement, to get the students involved in the real issues of the community.
Absolutely. So right. Rhonda could talk about the impact of impact.
Right, the impact of impact. So that's what I was talking about, those innovative mission projects, right? Accelerating community transformation. That's our impact, right? So that's an action word, right? The action verb, right? We're looking at, you know, what are we doing to really, truly make a difference? And we have over 1,000 partners now that are in our Impact Connects database is what we use. So we have partners go in and list what their needs are and what they're looking for. So where they're looking for volunteers, if they have opportunities for internships and employment, they can go into our database and list those things and our students can see them. But we also do things where instead of having the students just kind of look on this database and, you know, you do everything electronically, we have events every semester where we bring community-based organizations on the campus, right? And you can, I like to call it pick a project, right? Because mm-hmm. they list what their needs are and you have an opportunity to talk to some of those, sometimes the actual administrators of those organizations that come out and learn more about what the needs are in the community and opportunities. We always talk about opportunities because there are so many opportunities for our students, for the community-based organizations, and then the impact that is made through these collaborations is what's important and what we focus on.
This is What's Next, and we're finishing up our conversation about the Levesque Institute at Niagara University with us, Vice President Dr. Karen Quandrens, Associate Vice President, and also the Executive Director of the Levesque Institute, Rhonda Bivens-Talley. We've touched on a lot of different things. There's a lot going on. This is a wide-ranging effort. But NU at 8:22. I wanted to make sure that we mentioned this because this is a key effort from Niagara and from the Levesque Institute to, again, that extra step of ingraining yourself in the community of Niagara Falls.
Yeah, so this was something that started before Rhonda and I came to Niagara University. We've been here about 3 years now. The NU at 8:22 project was part of the Niagara Falls Downtown Revitalization Initiative, the downtown DRIs through economic development. So this was about 2019 that they originally got some funding for this. Again, the university feels very strongly about having a presence right into the community, and the work we're doing is all community based. So it'll save us a few miles going from campus into the community. So we are anticipating hearing from one of our funders soon and getting that project up and going. That will have classroom space. It'll have lecture halls. We'll have workforce development. It's an academic innovation hub. So our faculty, our staff can use that. And it's a beautiful church from 1856. So it's got quite a bit of history of abolitionists. It's got quite a, architecturally, it's gorgeous. So it'll be quite a anchor.
Right.
In the north end of the city of Niagara Falls. Prior to us closing for construction, we had quite a few speaking events there, and it was just really nice to see the community come out. Not only people driving there, but people walking there as well. We're close to the public library, we're close to schools, we're close to early childhood that the city of Niagara Falls is opening up, so it's going to be a great space for our students and faculty to do these community projects because they'll be so close to early childhood and the school district and other things right in the community. So we feel very strongly that this is where we belong, and the commitment of the Academic Innovation Hub is just another way that we show our commitment to the community.
Right. We're not looking at just having another pillar that we're adding to what we're doing. We're actually looking at being a pillar in the community.
Right.
So that's a difference. So we're looking at that. And how do we not only just establish our presence, but also how does having our presence there positively impact the community, right? So even looking at, when we're looking at the economic impact even, when we look at the work that our students do, like I collect all of that data through our Impact Connect system. So all the work that's being done on and off campus, we're looking at, well, what does that equate to? So we look at it and say, you know what, last year we looked, our annual report shows that our economic impact value was at over $2.9 million for the work that our students were doing because it's skills-based work. And the federal government actually attaches a particular dollar amount to that. So it's not numbers we're making up. These are actually federally mandated numbers that we're using to be able to calculate, you know, what is the value of what we're doing and giving back into the community in addition to the value that's added by what happens with those community-based organizations, the changes we see in the community, but also for our students, right? Being able to have an impact on them and have them better prepared. They'll be more skilled, better skilled workers by having these experiences in the community and working directly hands-on, not just talking about maybe writing a paper about something they had an experience for a couple of hours, but really seeing projects from the beginning into fruition to be able to really have a true experience and really be impacted positively, professionally and personally.
Yeah, you know, we're looking at really multifaceted ways to engage beyond like traditional engagement. And I think through our programs and our faculty involvement, our student involvement, and, you know, just the ways that we're working with the community, that we're really doing something fresh, doing some new things that normally aren't thought about.
And that will do it for Producer's Picks. We thank our guests, Kelly Wolf, Stephanie Pepper, Rachel Terapaki, Dr. Karen Quandrens, and Rhonda Bivens-Talley. If you missed anything or want to hear it again, you can get this program as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Each episode is online at WBFO.org. I'm Michael Loss. Thanks for listening.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.